such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Hallin Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my pleasure to be sitting in today for Father Anthony, as I do on most Mondays, along with my co-host, Loretta Freilich, who is a former criminal prosecutor for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Loretta, welcome.
Well, thank you, Mary.
Good to be back with you again.
It is always good on Monday when we're together.
It is. And we have a terrific show lined up for you today. Two real superstars in the arena of Catholic women at work in the world. Our first guest, and I do want to kind of get right to it because we have two really substantive conversations to have today about current issues and things that, unless you're hiding in a cave somewhere, you couldn't possibly avoid. And we want to make sure that you have a Catholic and Christian perspective on these two issues. The first is a case that the Supreme Court has heard oral arguments on, and you're probably seeing a lot about this in the secular media. The case is Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia, and it has to do with the rights, the religious practice rights of faith-based organizations to conduct their faith-based charitable works according to the tenets of their faith. And joining us to discuss this case will be Andrea Picciotti Baer, a friend of the show, who was a director at the Conscience Project. She is a Stanford-educated lawyer with her undergraduate degree from Northwestern University, so she spent some time here in Chicago. Her entire legal career has been dedicated to civil rights and to appellate advocacy. She started out in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, and she specialized there in institutional reform and enforcing federal civil rights laws in the appellate section. And while she was doing all of that, she also had the time to have 10 children. So she is a super mom, a super attorney. She's frequently contributing to Catholic media, the National Catholic Register, but she's also been published in the Washington Post, on CNN, the New York Post, the Washington Times, Crux, and she is also fluent in Spanish, so she is often on CNN en Español as well. So she lived in Colombia for over a decade, which is why her Spanish is as fluent as it is, though she now resides in the Washington, D.C. area. Andrea, welcome, and thank you for making time during what is such a busy season for you to be with us today.
No, it's so delightful because I love being with you all the time,
well,
whether
thank
it's
you.
By phone or in person, Mary.
Well, thank you, Andrea. Yeah. And our co-host Loretta has been very anxious to meet you, at least over the airwaves, until I can introduce the two of you in person.
Perfect. Andrea, it is so great to have you on this program. And, you know, when Mary was reading your introduction, you really just kind of make the word super seem sort of minimized.
Yeah.
you're kind of like, who is that? Wait. No, I think this is, it's all, the blessings of God.
Amen.
I mean, to be honest.
Yeah, thank you.
And,
yeah.
And I think that's, things come in your path for a reason. So hopefully I'm I'm not falling down on the job here.
I was saying to Loretta, if you're falling, you know, like every time I read through something of yours, I turn to Loretta. I said, don't you feel like you've done absolutely nothing with your life, Loretta?
No.
You're an awakening to our consciences, you know? But thank you.
I'm equally in awe of both of you.
Oh, God love you. God bless you. Yeah. And, well, thank you. Well, listen, this is, you know, I know you have never in your entire legal career shied away from difficult cases or much less controversial ones. So can you, for those in the general listening audience who might not be super familiar with the Fulton case, sort of just lay the groundwork for Fulton versus the City of Pennsylvania for us?
Absolutely. And I do think, just as kind of a warning in advance, there's going to be a lot of misinformation about this case.
Right. I've noticed so much already. That's why I wanted to have you on today, because just watching, I think in the last 10 days, a couple of news stories I've seen, I'm thinking, are you talking about the same case that I've read the amicus brief on? It doesn't seem the same. So please, Andrea, let us know. What are the facts?
You know, so the facts are this. City of Philadelphia, much like many cities and across the country, we've got a crisis in our foster care system. There are tons of needy children and a lack of homes. So what that means is kids who have suffered abuse and neglect in their homes of origin, where they should be receiving love and support and nurturing, they need to be in a different place to be safe and to be able to thrive. If there aren't loving, stable foster homes for these kids, they're being placed in congregate care. And anyone that's been a parent knows that the home is where you grow, and a loving home is where you thrive. So the Archdiocese of Philadelphia has been in the business for over two centuries to respond, as is our nature as Catholics, to the orphaned, and has been in the business of finding foster care homes for over 200 years, and for the last 50 years, they've done so in partnership with the city. And that's very typical. The city governments and state governments are taking more and more of an active role in what used to be kind of the province of state communities, especially the Catholic Church. Now, it's the only way for the Catholic Church to respond to this problem is in partnership with the city of Philadelphia. So that's a really important thing to start off with. Now, 3 years ago, I can't believe it's been 3 years already, but 3 years ago, there was a newspaper story about another faith-based foster care agency in Philadelphia that was approached by a same-sex couple to foster, and the Christian agency said, you know, we just can't work with you. That issue was flagged by the local newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Inquirer ran a big story where
Did it feel like this was a genuine request?
I don't believe that this was a case of a tester.
Okay.
And having been a civil rights attorney for a long time, there is an important role, for example, when we think especially of our housing laws.
Right.
Sometimes there's a housing provider, apartment complexes, and they're turning away all people that are Black. And testers, people that aren't really looking for housing, sometimes go there where you'll have a Black couple and a white couple, and they're given radically different treatment. And it's done, you know, with a cover of, oh, we don't have anything available. Here, that wasn't what was going on. First, I don't believe that there were testers. But it was, this is our policy because this is an outreach of our Christian ministry. Now, that wasn't at Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia. This is a different agency.
Okay.
That agency has since changed their policy. But the Catholic agency, when they were confronted by the newspaper reporter and later by city officials, said, look, Catholic teaching is that marriage is between a man and a woman, and what we can't do is certify a same-sex couple to be foster parents because we're certifying their marital relationship, their relationship.
Right.
And that's something that they have to do. They certify families all the time. They go in, They do a home study. What's going on? What are the relationships between people in the home where the child will be going? And they were being asked to certify a same-sex marriage. And they said that comes into conflict with Catholic teaching. We can't do it, but what we will do is we will refer any same-sex couple, none had ever come to us, but we will refer them happily to any of the other 29 agencies that are partnering with the city.
All of whom are willing to do placements with same-sex couples.
All of whom are willing to do. And some of them, two or three of them, have actually received the seal of approval from the Human Rights Council, which is a group that's very LGBTQ friendly, as being a place where same-sex couples will be given, you know, the supports that they need. So this isn't about shutting gay couples out of fostering. It is about religious freedom,
mm-hmm.
and is about allowing people to be able to serve consistent with the teachings of the church.
All right.
Now, what ended up happening, which is kind of crazy, is the city officials, and two of whom are raised Catholic and hold themselves out publicly as being Catholic, they were downright nasty. They were saying, you know, this isn't 100 years ago, times have changed, and they were trying to bully Catholic social services, which is, again, part of the diocese, the archdiocese, into changing their position. And they're being coherent with church teaching. So they bullied them. They said, we're no longer going to send you referrals to place children in the houses, the homes that have been certified. And eventually the city refused to renew the archdiocese contract. So this is kind of strong-arming at its ugliest.
Right. This is what's happened. We are very familiar with this here in Illinois because that's essentially what happened to Catholic Charities, foster care and adoption services in Illinois. Not quite as old as Philadelphia's, not quite as old as 200 years, but certainly well over 100 years that had been serving, you know, Catholic single mothers, unwed mothers, and running St. Vincent's Orphanage, one of the largest in the country, and doing placements primarily for Catholic families, many of whom, you know, the adoptions that we did, it was Catholic women who came to Catholic Charities because they wanted their child to be placed in a Catholic family with a mother and a father. So it was not only sort of violative of the rights of, you know, the Catholic Church in the state of Illinois to practice as they had for decades and decades and decades prior their faith in terms of their ministerial work, but also, you know, the birth mothers and the families they were serving largely who came to them because they were Catholic and wanted them to be placed with Catholic families. And, you know, there are evangelical and Lutheran social services and other social service agencies that are secular in nature, but all of whom were happy to place with, you know, a variety of different family units. But it seemed the state was not satisfied unless we changed our beliefs and our behavior in order to reflect these new secular norms.
Well, and Mary, you make a really good point about meeting the needs of the child first, right? Child-focused and child-centered efforts, and making referrals when a referral to a different agency is in the best interest of the family,
right?
Whether it's the biological parents and their desire that the child be, you know, in a religious home that's consistent with the home that either through adoption or if the child is able to return back to their home of origin. But that's something that's happening in Philadelphia all the time.
Yeah.
Someone will come in and a child will come in, whether it's a sibling group or a child with a special background or special needs, and the agency can make a referral to a different agency.
Right.
Because the goal in all of this is these kids have suffered unimaginable situations. When you get to the point where you need to remove a child from their home of origin, either it's abuse or neglect of the kind that we can't even fathom.
Right, exactly. And so, it's done in other contexts, as you point out.
If
a child has special needs or if there's,
And done on contexts in which the law, you know, anti-discrimination law applies. So it can be for racial reasons. So right. if there's a child that comes from a particular race or ethnic background and there's a family with a different agency to be able to allow for that, it's not always going to happen. And oftentimes it may not be a factor, but it can also be, you know, whether on the basis of disability, there's a family that is prepared to assume the special needs of a child with special, you know, disabilities or learning needs or whatnot.
So yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So yeah, so it's not like it's unheard of to make that kind of referral to different agencies. And again, the needs of the child should be driving it, and keeping the agency true to their mission.
Yes, right, and allowing them to work according to their own consciences, and not having a government agency forcing religious institutions to act against their consciences, which is also sort of a core issue, I think. And it's not dissimilar to Masterpiece Cake Shop, is it, in some ways? Because I know that in that case, which I do think actually was a test case, the couple came in, the baker in question was well known in the community as an evangelical Christian. He did not do stag party cakes. He did not do Halloween cakes. You know, most evangelicals do not observe Halloween. He wouldn't do divorce cakes. That's apparently a thing. I didn't know you get a cake and then like you cut it in half, like you break it. So he didn't do those. So there, it wasn't just he didn't do same-sex wedding cakes. There were a whole number of cakes, not a huge list, but a fairly significant number that he was known for not doing. So if you want kind of a graphic cake for your stag party, you don't go to him. He wouldn't accept the work, but he would say, you know, there's bakeries all over town that will happily, you know, meet your needs. So, so Andrea, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this, and we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'd like to, if you could, walk us through how you felt the oral arguments went.
Fantastic.
Okay, super, terrific. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Every parent has a dream of giving their children a great education and great faith. St. Stanislaus Kostka School, a nationally acclaimed Catholic leadership school, has made the dream easier for you to achieve. Here, leadership principles and lessons are an integral part of your child's coursework and school culture. Your child will study foreign languages, such as Mandarin, conduct experiments in real science labs, attend Eucharistic adoration, and more. Don't worry about affording a private education. St. Stanislaus Kostka School offers full tuition scholarships for kindergarten through eighth grade. Send your child to St. Stanislaus Kostka School, located just minutes from downtown Chicago. Dreams can come true, but you need to call today, 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. 773-278-4560.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. It's not too late to register for the 2021-2022 school year at St. Stan's. Seats are limited. For more information or to schedule a tour, call 773-278-4560.
773-278-4560. And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
And we are back, and we're having a happy show today here in the studio. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in for Father Anthony here on Listener-Supported Winds of Change. We are joined this half hour by the Conscience Project's director and super attorney, Stanford Law grad, Andrea Picciotti, and we're talking about the Fulton versus City of
Philadelphia.
I want to say yes. City of Pennsylvania. They're all too many P's. There's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. Okay, so.
Well, you know, the question that I have, Andrea, is that it doesn't make logical sense with so many kids out there that need a loving, caring home that would clearly be vetted by the Archdiocese Catholic Charities. Why are they taking this opportunity to remove their contract, and then what can they do to reinstate that contract?
Yeah, no, I think that you are spot on in thinking about the insanity. Sometimes when there's, I like to call it the demand for ideological conformity, everyone needs to think the same way, and that's something that's being pushed by a lot of progressive groups right now. They don't allow for a diversity of thought. And when you don't allow for diversity of thought, you get terrible results. And that's really what's going on.
And so the Supreme Court heard oral arguments. And how do you feel like they went? I know a lot of the court watchers, you know, tend to go to oral arguments. And then based on the questioning from the justices, you know, try to kind of draw up a kind of a guesstimate of where the court's going to go and what the court was concerned about. And so I want you, if you could tell us a little bit about that, and then what you think this case might mean for Employment Division versus Smith.
Perfect. No, fortunately for me, the oral arguments were held over the telephone. They're still being held telephonically.
Oh, they're not. Wow, I didn't realize that. They're still not back in.
So,
okay.
It was in November, and so it was great because you didn't have to wait like at 5 o'clock in the morning to be in a big long line to get in. It's really been a wonderful chance, I think, for a lot of people to get a look at the third branch, our judiciary, our Supreme Court, which tends to be kind of in the shadows. You know, you don't know what's really going on much until a decision comes. It was a fantastic argument. It was one of the first that Justice Amy Coney Barrett participated in. And both she and Chief Justice John Roberts are parents of adopted children. So I think this really gave them a particular sensitivity into the importance of agencies that support parents, whether they're foster or adopted parents. Surprisingly, in the oral argument, some of the left-leaning justices were scratching their heads as well. Justice Stephen Breyer said, wait a second, I don't understand. Why was this contract rescinded if nobody was ever turned away? So that was a really great sign. But from the more conservative-leaning justices like Justice Samuel Alito, I think they really understood that this is an affront to traditional religious beliefs on the nature of marriage. And he brought the case back, he and Justice Brett Kavanaugh, to the Supreme Court's case, I guess it was over 6 years ago now, Obergefell,
right,
where the court kind of read into a right to same-sex marriage into the Constitution, but even in that opinion recognized that there were going to be people with religious objections to that, that very broad decision, and that the First Amendment protects their right to object, both, you know, their right to object in their speech
right,
and also their right to object based on the free exercise of religion. So where are we heading now? Well, there's a couple different routes, I think. One is what Mary alluded to. It could be kind of like Masterpiece Cake Shop, where the Supreme Court chastises the city of Philadelphia for being nasty.
Yeah,
they were incredibly disrespectful to Catholic teaching and very intolerant, and they could be redirected to treat religious objections with less hostility and see, you know, that could be the first way. That's a very tame approach that they could take. The second approach is to revisit a case that came out in 1990, and that's Employment Division versus Smith. It was written by the late Justice Antonin Scalia, and it said, if there's a neutral and generally applicable anti-discrimination law, or any law, and it tends to burden religion, not target religion, but burden religion, the state or the government doesn't need to make an accommodation. Basically, if it affects everybody, you don't have to make an accommodation for the people that object based on religion. That's proven profoundly unworkable, mm-hmm. especially in these issues of marriage.
And so surprising coming from Scalia. I mean, it's always been the one case that's baffled me out of all of his, you know, tremendous legacy of jurisprudence. That's the one case that sort of sticks out as I don't know what he was thinking.
Well, and, you know, I think it was a great book was recently written by Judge Ken Starr, mm-hmm. who's famous for the Clinton impeachment proceeding. And he kind of took to task. He said, you know, Scalia is so great, but he made a mistake.
Yeah.
And human beings make mistakes. Now, how does the court deal with that? The court is very reluctant to overrule cases entirely, but they do occasionally, and that could be one consequence that they decide to overrule Smith and come up with a more nuanced look at how do we deal with accommodating religious objection, which is part of our history. The other that they approach that they could do is keep the Smith case alive and find kind of a way around it, I guess, in the context of these very difficult situations where you've got what looks to be a targeted attack against faith-based groups. And an easy accommodation. This is not going to be frustrating the city's general interest in encouraging more of its residents to foster. So it could be a way to say, you know, unless it completely frustrates your interest, you have to find an accommodation for right. religious sectors. And that's something that we see in dealing with other civil rights laws. Is this the least restrictive means possible? So bringing that kind of ethic into the very difficult issues, especially in the social services context.
Now, Andrea, can you tell us, what do you think this case will do? What kind of chilling effect do you have, do you think there will be if they go ahead and rule in favor of the city of Philadelphia?
Well, we've already seen the chilling effect that you mentioned, just like in the state of Illinois, when these agencies have been pushed and put up against the wall to either betray religious teaching or serve, they've pivoted and used their resources for other social services. So that could be the end of a lot of faith-based foster care and adoption. Some of our evangelical brothers and sisters, their agencies have changed policy. Catholic agencies won't. And there are some live cases involving the state of Michigan right now, just across the lake, where Catholic agencies are pushing back against this demand to renounce Catholic teaching. So it will be really hard for those live cases. It could be that a lot of Catholic agencies that have been doing this for a long time kind of preemptively switch their attention. But I think given that the numbers, you know, just for your listeners to know, over 400,000 kids in the U.S. in foster care, and I suspect that number is going to increase in light of all the pressures that the pandemic has brought on parents. So this is serious stuff. We don't want doors to close. We want more doors to be opened. And given the track record that Catholic agencies have had over the years, they really bring solid, loving, beautiful homes.
Yes.
Into that wonderful service.
You know, Andrea, I am the recipient of the beauty of the Catholic adoption system in that four of my cousins are adopted through Catholic Charities. And, you know, I can't imagine what my life would be without the blessing of them. And so I really want to thank you on behalf of all of the kids out there that won't have that opportunity if this case goes south. And I truly just I'm going to keep you in my prayers because, wow, you are doing a tremendous service to those with no voice.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, right now we all really need to pray. Pray that, what is good and true and beautiful come out of the Supreme Court. They've been great defenders of religious freedom. And just like you said, there are needy kids that are really waiting on them to come to their aid.
Right. And even beyond all of the, you know, the back and forth and the, you know, kind of name calling that's being thrown around, at the end of the day, real children who need good homes are sort of left in the lurch here. And I do feel it's also sort of a I told you so moment for Justice Samuel Alito, isn't it? Because in Obergefell, his dissent in Obergefell specifically says, you know, we were told all along that if we change the definition of marriage and find a right to marriage between two people of the same sex, that it won't affect anybody. This won't hurt anybody. This won't, you know, affect any other organization or person or couple. It will only be a benefit to the couples who already live together and, you know, act as if they were married, who are kept from certain federal benefits and, you know, other types of status or, you know, hospital visitation rights, you know, frankly, all things that could be handled by statute without changing marriage's definition. But we were told that, listen, this is a private thing. It's not going to affect anybody else. And he was right. He warned. He said, sure enough, you know, you watch in a couple of years, those who believe that marriage is between a man and a woman are going to be the ones who are you know, canceled, for lack of a better word, or, you know, told that they need to keep up with the times and that they actually need to change their thinking on this. And that's exactly what we've seen happening. And, you know, I love your website. And listeners, I would direct you to the Conscience Project at, I think it's conscience-project.org. Is that it?
That's perfect.
Okay, and you can link to some more information about Justice Alito there, and he gave a marvelous talk last year to the Federalist Society where he went into this in depth, and it's really, really worth your time. I've listened to it a couple of times already,
yeah.
And I find like I pick up something new every time I do. So, Andrea, when are we expecting a decision from the court? Would it be coming sometime this June?
You know, this is very exciting. The Supreme Court ends its term at the end of June, and so they announce the release of opinions usually a couple days in advance. Today they were they released some opinions, and everyone was like, it's going to be Fulton. And it wasn't Fulton. They're releasing another batch of opinions on Thursday. So in the next 3 weeks, things are coming. I'm really hoping that Justice Alito writes the majority opinion.
Yes.
And he just has figured this out. And it really is a case, I think, the greatest example that we got is from the wonderful people at the Archdiocese in Philadelphia. This isn't an either-or situation.
Right.
Side for the Archdiocese foster care program does not leave anyone in the lurch. And so we really need to talk about, there's a way that we can still hold true to our beliefs and not turn anyone away from this important mission, which is to offer and open up homes to kids in need.
Amen. And Andrea, this is Loretta. I also want to thank you for being with us and for all of our listeners out there who don't have Mary's brilliant mind and are able to read Supreme Court opinions in her spare time. We just want to ask you to pray that the Archdiocese of Philadelphia's foster care placement agency's contract is reinstated. And I think what Andrea said was beautiful. We want to pray that what is good, true, and beautiful comes out of the Supreme Court. And we want to pray especially for all the kids in foster care and for Andrea Piacotti Beyer and all of her good work at the Conscience Project, that they are successful in everything they take their hand to with God's will.
Yeah, and Andrea, thank you again for making time for us. I know, again, this is a very busy season for you, and we're very grateful for your help and for being with us, and we hope we can have you back on after the decision comes out for your analysis.
Super, I would terrific. Definitely love to.
Well, thank you. This Andrea Picciotti of the Conscience Project. You can find her at conscience.org. www.thecellerpiece-project.org. And Andrea, again, thank you for being with us. And listeners, don't go away. When we come back, we'll have author Noelle Mehring to talk to her about her new book, Awake Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. Don't go away.
St. Stan's needs your help. We are forming a group of volunteers called St. Stan's Cares to help parish and school families in times of need. To join the group or learn more, please contact Brian at 312-343-3222, and we will plan an upcoming virtual meeting to discuss the details. Almsgiving, it's one of the three pillars of Lent. Volunteer with St. Stan's Cares as a means of almsgiving.
We are the students of St. Stan LaCosta Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. It's not too late to register for the 2021-2022 school year at St. Stan's. Seats are limited. For more information or to schedule a tour, call 773-278-4560.
773-278-4560. And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
Every parent has a dream of giving their children a great education and great faith. St. Stanislaus Kostka School, a nationally acclaimed Catholic leadership school, has made the dream easier for you to achieve. Here, leadership principles and lessons are an integral part of your child's coursework and school culture. Your child will study foreign languages, such as Mandarin, conduct experiments in real science labs, attend Eucharistic adoration, and more. Don't worry about affording a private education. St. Stanislaus Kostka School offers full tuition scholarships for kindergarten through eighth grade. Send your child to St. Stanislaus Kostka School, located just minutes from downtown Chicago. Dreams can come true, but you need to call today, 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. 773-278-4560.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in today for Father Anthony, as we do on most Mondays here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we are so pleased this second half of our show to be joined by my colleague at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Noelle Mehring. She's also a fellow there with me. She is the co-author of two books I would highly recommend if you're going to any June weddings or wedding showers. They make a great wedding shower gift or a wedding gift. Theology of the Home 1 and Theology of the Home 2. Beautiful books about creating that domestic church that is the Catholic Christian family. Noelle is a frequent contributor to the National Catholic Register, The American Mind, The Federalist, Catholic World Report. She's an editor at theologyofthehome.com, and she lives with her husband and their six children in beautiful Southern California. And Noelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Noelle, this is Loretta Fralick, Mary's co-host. I want to thank you for your wonderful book. I'm going to admit I'm not all the way through it, but I just am so hopeful after reading, and you just engage so well with the secular culture in ways in which we can implement and live out our Catholic faith. And I was really impressed with the way that you attacked the issue. And so I just want to know, how is it you came to write this book?
Oh, thanks so much for the kind words. Well, I've always been interested in this subject matter, just the progressivism in Christianity and how Christians ought to be in the world and what's politically their positions should be and can be. And I've had family members and dear friends who are very progressive and also, very intentional in their faith. So it just was always totally fascinating discussion and concept to me, and I started writing articles about the woke culture in 2018, 2019, and this pattern of a mercilessness that I kept seeing recurring in a movement about justice. It was surprisingly merciless, and that became a really interesting concept to me. And it just started happening where I would hear more and more stories at kind of Orthodox Christian or Catholic schools, where it wasn't just these kind of the more progressive secular schools, but it was actually starting to have this movement was affecting Christian institutions too, and really kind of creating very divisive and toxic environments for the students.
Mm-hmm.
So that became it just started becoming clear to me that we need to have a clear Christian response to what was happening.
Okay. Now you identify woke ideology. Can you tell our listeners what that is?
Sure. The simplest definition is that the term woke refers to the state of being alert and attuned to the layers of pervasive oppression in society. It originated specifically with regard to racism, but it's since broadened to include all areas of social oppression, commonly considered to be, along the lines of gender, race, sexuality. And specific acts of injustice are used to serve the larger goal of furthering ideology that sees all human interaction as a power contest.
And what about, can you explain to our listeners what critical race theory is? I know we talk about it a lot, but do we really know what it means and what its goal is?
Yeah, great question. So critical race theory, its origins stem from critical theory, which it was the neo-Marxist, neo-Freudian thing that happened at the Frankfurt School that was established by the German Marxists who came over to kind of embed sort of critical theory in the West. Critical race theory is an offshoot of that, and it serves basically to say that racism is pervasive, invisible, and omnipresent. So, for example, Robin DiAngelo, the woman who wrote White Fragility, she famously will say, in any human interaction, the question is never did racism occur, but how did it occur, with the assumption that it is everywhere. So it's taking that critical lens to seeing that power and oppression dynamics in every institution and interaction and trying to revolt against it and eventually reverse the power structure.
Okay. What I find particularly interesting is how you identify that this is a spiritual battle.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we need to understand that this is ultimately establishing a new type of religion. And so one of the ways that I think it preys on sort of the precepts of Christianity to be compassionate, to walk along with the suffering and the marginalized. Those are good, obviously very Christian understandings of how we ought to be in the world. But then it introduces fundamental distortions that are diametrically opposed to Christianity.
Right.
And so eventually it would replace Christ in the hearts of men if it's allowed to take hold within, the way they understand their faith is through this critical lens. Even Christ himself, they will eventually choose the ideology over Christ if you follow the logic of it.
And what do you find is the best way to respond to this? How do we get ourselves out of here?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the last quarter of the book is all about the restoration and how to get climb our way out of it. So, I think there's two things we really need, clarity and courage. So the movement really operates on confusion and kind of confusing individuals and about what true compassion is. And so the more clarity we have and understand, in the book I treat it like a religion. I have it. It has its origins, dogmas, and indoctrination. So the more we can have clarity on how it operates and what its ultimate aims are, then the more we'll be building up a wall where we can't be susceptible to that type of confusion. But secondly, we also really need courage. So, it's fundamentally based on a lie, and a lie is threatened by people speaking the truth. But so they really tried to demagogue and to, cancel all these, repressive tolerance, this type of thing, where the opposition is not allowed to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to defy that by just being very courageous.
Well, I find that...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Noah. I find that really incredible that we're the only ones they're not tolerant of. Everybody else gets the big tolerant pass. And, it's just... Those of us that are speaking the truth with the clarity and courage are out of the box. We're accused of being intolerant.
Right. And I think that tolerance was really just a sort of a Trojan horse that introduced, if you have to kind of break down any societal norm because it'll be judgmental if you don't allow, all these different lifestyles to kind of exist on their own. But But ultimately, there, you know, that's where your point is something real, which is that a movement about tolerance is fundamentally going to have to become intolerant at some point, that right. they have their own messianic vision of what society should look like.
Noel, it's Mary again. I you know, find that this is so, it's so pervasive now within our culture that even if you send your kids to Catholic schools, that they're not completely protected, and in many cases, they're not protected at all from you know, not just the ideology, but with the vocabulary, without substance behind it that comes with it, you know? So, I mean, so much so, I have a funny story. This is a couple of months ago. My husband had built a snowman out in the back, the front yard, actually, and for our neighbor, and my seventh grader came in and said, "Mom, that snowman looks really judgmental." And, you know, so I was thinking, what on earth? You know, so anyway, she felt it was judging our neighbors because of the look in its little coal face there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, but, you know, I loved a lot of the book, but in particular, you quoted Cardinal George. So any book that quotes Cardinal George, of course, starts out with a very high mark for me. But saying, you know, we live in a society that it permits everything but forgives nothing. And, you know, he had a PhD in philosophy as well as in theology. And his PhD in philosophy was specifically in American philosophy, which he said after he wound up getting the PhD in it, he discovered he didn't like very much. So he, but you see sort of the, and this would have been, you know, I think, you know, the time of his death 5.5 years ago, critical race theory really wasn't a common phrase you heard, you know, and now it's, you can't turn on any talk show, whether it's radio or television, and not hear it. But at sort of the center of your book, you write, "The suppression of meaning is the deepest form of oppression and slavery that human beings can exact upon another." And I know you were speaking about Viktor Frankl and specifically when you wrote that, but can you, that to me just, that kind of felt like someone had thrown a glass of cold water in my face when I read that, because you see that where suicide and despair really come into play is where people, A, they have no one to love, they don't have something to love, they don't have anything to look forward to, so there's no meaning in their life. So can you expand upon that a little bit and how we see this sort of suppression of meaning in the woke ideology?
Sure, yeah, no, I think it's such a crucial point. You know, I mean, I think it happens in many ways. So, for example, postmodernism is directly informing woke ideology, which means that there's no grand narrative, there's no ultimate meaning to our lives. But you also see it in the way the transgender movement and the sexual revolution, both of which say that there's no fundamental intelligible meaning to our bodies, that we can, you know, and it leads to all sorts of paradoxes where you can do whatever you want with your body as long as there's consent. But a hug that wasn't, you know, welcomed is a form of sexual assault. So it's this bizarre way of depersonalizing everything, and then it results in a culture, a society that takes everything personally. And I think that's because we've done away with the metric. But so the meaning, without the meaning, one of the outgrowths of that is that we don't know how to suffer well. And so if we don't know how to suffer well, so we wind up suffering loudly. You know, we suffer with screams and with rage because we don't have an architecture of meaning in which to put our suffering into context, to have it serve a higher purpose, and ultimately to have us serve a higher purpose. So, you know, and that's the irony, that a society that's decadent, that's all about myself, ends up being a society in total despair because, you know, we all experience this, that you don't find joy by fulfilling your desires. You actually find, you know, a meaninglessness and a despair. So that's why we've, you know, the suicide rates and the epidemic of loneliness, you know, that people are talking about all the time. But these things are real because we've deprived people of that meaning, that deeper meaning to their lives, of service and of virtue. And so, yeah, it's the most troubling aspect of it to me.
Additionally, Noel, this is Loretta again. Additionally, there's an awful lot of violence in our culture today. And everything seems to be, that violence seems to be the response to everything. A court verdict, a shooting. And what does the woke ideology do to promote that violence?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the shift from critical thinking to critical theory, for example. So in the book, you know, I talk about three fundamental dogmas of the movement, and one of them being that our will triumphs over our reason and our ability to reason together. So critical theory has, whereas critical thinking, where the goal is truth. So when you disagree with someone or when there's, you know, some societal conflict, then you can debate, you can have different points of view, you can reanalyze. You know, you're trying to arrive at truth, so you welcome objections. For critical theory, the goal is not truth, but power. And so the response to an oppression is what they perceived oppressive power is to dominance. You have to fight back, not with reason or words or debate, but with force and coercion. And so that's why I think that the violence is the natural outgrowth. You know, it's a movement ultimately pointed towards revolution. And so if not stopped, I think we're going to see more of it, more riots, more violence in the streets.
And what about between the races? I'm just amazed at how difficult it is to have a conversation now to even end any type of racism, because we're all told now that we're systematically racist.
Yeah, it's you know, another irony there is that the way that the critical theorists and the diversity DEI experts talk about the races is incredibly racist, right? So
right.
I think we've all heard about, you know, that they'll teach that being on time is a white virtue, hard work is a white virtue, rationality, objectivity, these are white dominant virtues. And that's that's incredibly racist. So what, you know, it's mimicking the, like, a white supremacist language. And to the point where I just saw the study that white liberal or progressive people think less that black people are less capable than what black people think of themselves. So they believe in themselves more than the white liberal who's supposed to be compassionate. It's a deeply disempowering message, you know, to say that any success or failure in life is going to be, can only be attributed to this systemic force outside of yourself. Well, we never would say that to anyone who is teaching someone or mentoring someone to be successful in life, to you know, triumph above their circumstances. The first message that you give them is that you can triumph over your circumstances.
Amen.
You know, that you're not the victim of them. You can take responsibility, pick yourself up, you know, and it's not a naive message that, you know, we're all have equality of opportunity. Certainly there's, you know, injustices in society, and people need a leg up, and some people have a much harder road than others. These things are all true. But to respond to that reality by saying, therefore, you do not have the ability to combat this structural system against you, well, that's going to lead to anger, resentment, and, you know, an inability to conquer your circumstances. So it just seems to me like such a deeply harmful and ultimately racist message.
And now, you said earlier in the program that in order to resist this and to make change in the world, we must do it with clarity and courage. How do you recommend that we do that?
I think first and foremost, we have to understand what's happening. And then I think we can, you know, different people are going to be called to work in different, you know, different degrees and different levels. I mean, obviously, you know, not everyone's going to be writing articles against this or, you know, passing laws or a legislature. You know, there are different callings that different people have. But one of the deepest ways I think we can combat this is once we realize this is a spiritual battle, mm-hmm. where we all have access to the sacraments and the way in which that can really fight, we really have to arm ourselves with the sacraments. And here's mm-hmm. The church in her wisdom giving us the sacrament of confession in particular. Confession really stands in my mind as the polar opposite of the woke movement. The woke movement encourages us to look outside of ourselves and accuse, see the sins of the others, and to not take any blame for myself. Well, in confession, it's incredibly difficult. We have to look at ourselves, our own sins, and through my fault, and not excuse them, not deflect from them, just really see them. And if we aren't willing to see our sins, we won't see our need. We won't look for a savior, you know, and so that seems to me one of the more pernicious elements of it. But it is through that wisdom of the church and the sacraments that we really can arm ourselves and combat this with those spiritual weapons.
Well, I have to tell you, Noel, you might just be my favorite guest, aligning the sacraments with a solution to a spiritual problem and in a secular world. That is great, and great advice.
Oh, good.
And so, Noel, it's Mary again. Tell me what, I've read some reviews of your book, and I've seen some articles, you know, here and there, and saw your appearance on Fox News. What do you get the sense has been sort of the overall reaction to what you have written here? And I haven't seen. I think your book really must have been inspired, because it's one of the first I've seen kind of taking this ideology on, sort of, you know, in a very direct way, like you say, armed with our Christian faith to respond to it. How has the reaction to the book been? You know, first of all, among people who would be like-minded, but secondly, have you had any interviews with people who might not share your viewpoints, and how have they reacted to your work? Because it's so scholarly, and I like that you back up everything that you're saying with facts and with information and with, you know, and not just with feeling.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, I appreciate you saying it's scholarly. I feel that I don't have a PhD. I'm not, I really want this book to be a book that anyone can read, accessible, but still substantive. And so I'm trying to really focus on uniting those two things so that, to address your question in particular, I do have progressive friends and family members who have been reading it, and, you know, they're giving me good feedback. I think that it feels like there's enough concern for the human person that, you know, it's not overly polemical. Which I was really striving to just really be motivated to write this out of love for persons, not you know, to dunk on the lips or something.
Right.
I think the overall reaction that I've been getting, and it's hard to sift through because I'm too close to it to kind of, I take the 30,000 degree look at from the bird's eye view. But one of the most reactions I'm getting is that it feels like a niche that was needed to be filled.
Yes. You know, absolutely.
There's academic books about it to some degree, and that there's, you know, James Lindsay's doing great work and Christopher Rufo, but there wasn't really analyzing it as a spiritual thing. And so I'm glad to fill that hole and honored that people are reading it and responding well.
And, you know, Noelle, like I said when we first started, I have hope. Your book gives me hope. You're identifying the problem. You isolate the issue. You are able to provide. You're able to provide that clarity and courage that you talked about. It is. I can't wait to get to the end to see how it's all supposed to turn out. But that may be in another lifetime. But I certainly will finish the book, and I highly recommend anyone. I was so excited as I started reading it, and so I think that anybody out there that is just frustrated with this abyss needs to take a look at Awake Not Woke, and
right.
It's a great read.
Well, and you know, Noelle, just as we're wrapping up in the last couple of minutes that we have, I like that you, it's not just theory you're speaking about. You're speaking about the lives of real people and how this ideology has, in some cases, wreaked havoc with people's lives. And one of the examples of that you bring up is Memory's Pizza, which we know here in Chicago because it's not super far from us here in Chicago, the South Bend, Indiana area. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about what happened in that particular instance and why you bring it up in your book as an example of how the mob, group over person, it's in that chapter, group over person, how that ideology, how when put into practice, how it damages people?
Yeah, so one of the tactics is to isolate and freeze narratives of oppression and then emphasize them over and over again to the point where we lose any perspective of what's actually happening. So the Memories Pizza, there was that's when the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was under attack for being anti-gay. And so a reporter was looking for a villain and went to a small town, Indiana pizzeria, and posed the question to the Christian owners about their business practices regarding gay people. Would they serve them? Would they cater a hypothetical wedding? And the owners told the reporter that, you know, they would never deny service to anyone, but that they couldn't cater a wedding, as that would be a violation of their convictions.
Right.
The national news media really seized on the story and went, you know, the story went viral, and they just needed a concrete representation of homophobia. It didn't matter if these people were not like advertising that they would, you know, they were,
or that no one really has a wedding reception in a pizzeria in, you know, rural Indiana anyway. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It was like the most vulnerable person that they could and then try and destroy them. So, well, the book again is Awake Not Woke. The author, Noelle Mehring, we would highly recommend it. Both Loretta and I give it two thumbs up. Noelle Mehring, thank you for being with us today, to giving us so much time, and good luck with the book.
Thanks, Noel.
All right. And this has been Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Have a great week, and we'll be with you again next Monday.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.